From Wyoming to Ohio, Alaska to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the inflation rate held steady in May, but remains above the Fed's targeted rate. Brian Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute joins us with details. Once again, the Biden administration is trying to force consumers into electric vehicles by placing restrictions on the manufacture of gas and diesel-powered vehicles. We talk with Phil Kirpin from American Commitment. And it is yet another federal government tech disaster. The rollout of the form millions of college students must use to apply for federal aid was botched. Eric Boehm and Emma Camp of Reason Magazine report. And the first presidential debate, now just days away, but will either candidate benefit? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Inflation continues to be well above the Federal Reserve's target rate, but it held steady during the month of May. This is delaying expected interest rate cuts. Ryan Young is a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We turn to him from time to time to parse through the numbers. Ryan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ryan, we now have numbers from the month of May relative to inflation, also the consumer price index, the producer price index. What happened with inflation in the month of May? Any significant movement?
There was very little movement. One bit of good news is that the month-over-month inflation in May was actually flat. The same thing happened last summer during, I believe, June and July. But the year-over-year inflation, how much the price has gone up over the last year, that stayed almost identical. It moved down from 3.4% to 3.3%, which is still about 50% higher than our goal, which is 2%. So we've made a lot of progress since the days of 9% inflation, but that last mile is proving very difficult.
The rate of inflation has come down, but have we moved past the impact of the cumulative, what now, almost 20% inflation that we've had over the last 3.5-4 years?
No, that is permanent. And I would actually argue that it moving back to 2019 price levels would be a mistake, because that would require 20% deflation. As bad as inflation is just as bad. So the economy, we would be best off if we would just settle at this new price level, get inflation as low as possible, and then keep it that way for as long as we can.
So that's where we are. What about wages? Have we seen real wage growth, real income growth keep pace with inflation?
Yes, we have. It took a while to keep up, or it took a while to be that way, because while gas prices and grocery prices can adjust almost instantaneously, most of us get a pay raise maybe once a year. So there was a bit of a lag, but over the last, I believe, year and a half or so, real wages have been outpacing inflation. So it may not feel like it because you see those higher prices everywhere, but people's paychecks, for the most part, are keeping up, even though there is a bit of a lag.
In terms of interest rates here, Ryan, the Fed has been, for the last couple of years now, on a track to try and cut inflation. They're having some success at that, but as you pointed out, not quite there yet. The Fed did have a meeting here a week or so ago. What decision did they make relative to interest rates?
They held interest rates steady, which is about what everyone expected. But underneath the surface, they've been doing something that I find very concerning. At their previous meeting 6 or 7 weeks ago, they decided to slow down how fast they're drawing back their balance sheet. And interest rates matter, but that balance sheet is ultimately far more important for inflation. The golden rule of inflation is that if you print a bunch of money, you're going to get inflation. And what the Fed did when COVID hit is that it panicked and it grew that balance sheet by $5 trillion. It created $5 trillion of new money, quadrupled the usual rate. And what do you know? The inflation rate quadrupled. They've been drawing it back since, very slowly, and then they announced that they're going to draw it back more slowly still, which might be a pivot point towards actually going back to increasing it like they did during the big inflation and causing more stimulus, more inflation. And markets are seeing that and noticing it, and they're factoring that into their prices today. So that is just bad news all around.
there was a lot of speculation headed into this year here, Ryan, that the Fed would in fact start a ratcheting down then of the interest rate, assumedly getting inflation under control. That hasn't happened. Are they signaling any rate cuts here this year? I actually read one article where there was some speculation we may have yet another increase.
Well, the Fed wants to do one rate cut this year. They want to cut rates all around because when they raise interest rates like they have for the last 2 years, that causes mortgage rates to go up, that causes credit card interest rates, car payments, student loans, all other interest rates to go up. So they want to cut rates, but they can't because higher interest rates are an inflation-fighting tool. So the Fed needs to have higher interest rates to help get inflation under control. It's not as powerful as that balance sheet that we just talked about, but the interest rate is one more tool in the Fed's pocket that it needs to keep using. So hopefully they don't cut, but I don't think they're going to increase either.
There have been a number of polls in recent weeks where pollsters have asked if voters think that we are in a recession, and a substantial majority do think we are in a recession, which technically we are not. Why is it that so many Americans think that we're in a recession? Is this maybe the first kitchen table recession we've ever had where we aren't actually there, but people think we are?
It's actually very common. I think most people just have a built-in pessimistic bias. Back in the 1990s, when there was that dot-com boom, unemployment was low, the economy was growing like gangbusters, more than half of the country thought we were in a recession. And we're seeing the same thing today. And I think the other, probably more important issue today is, like you mentioned, the dollar has devalued by 20% since COVID-19. That means that prices are higher across the board, and people see those higher prices, and they don't necessarily realize the difference between nominal prices and real prices. Yes, nominal prices are higher, but in terms of real purchasing power, because their paychecks have gone up to match for the most part, they don't really put two and two together. So you add those two things together, the pessimistic bias and that money illusion is what economists call it, and I think that's why we have a kitchen table recession, and thankfully not the real thing.
Congress, of course, has a big impact on all of this with its spending practices. Has Congress learned its lesson to any degree? Do we have any big spending proposals on the agenda, on the table right now?
They have not learned their lesson, but fortunately, this being an election year, they don't want to make any waves. So I don't see any big spending proposals beyond the usual budgeting exercises coming this year. And that's good because the Fed, while I blame them for causing the inflation with their massive stimulus spree, a fair amount of that $5 trillion was also in order to help finance Congress and President Trump and Biden's bipartisan spending spree. So that threat's always in the background. And frankly, because markets know this, that's part of why that last mile of inflation, getting from 3% down to the 2% target, is proving so elusive because markets don't trust Congress or the Fed.
Ryan Young is a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Ryan, tell us a bit about CEI. Also, where can folks find you on the web?
CEI is a think tank based in Washington, and we study the regulatory aspects of every issue from finance to energy and environment to technology. Our website is CEI.org.
Ryan Young of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson has the week off, so we go now to Phil Kirpin of American Commitment to discuss the Biden administration's plan to limit the production of gas and diesel-powered vehicles, this in an effort to force more Americans into electric vehicles. Phil, good to have you back with us. Phil, what we are seeing out of the Biden administration and the left as a whole, generally speaking, is their desire to micromanage every facet of our daily lives. We're going to talk about a number of areas where they're moving in that direction. Starting out with electric vehicles, once again, by fiat, the Biden administration is wanting to put a limit on the number of gas-powered vehicles here. Want to tell us what their goal is?
It's pretty remarkable. We're looking at such massive, lavish subsidies that you might think, oh, electric vehicle sales are just going to go up and up and up and up as they had been for the past several years. I mean, there's all-in subsidies now between the tax and regulatory subsidies, state and federal, are something like $40,000 per vehicle, and yet they've really plateaued. They've leveled out, and the Biden administration, rather than maybe admitting perhaps there are a lot of customers out there that don't want EVs, no matter how lavishly they subsidize them, their response is, well, let's ban the competition. Let's mandate that people get EVs by restricting the market share of internal combustion vehicles that manufacturers are allowed to sell on an annual basis. And so they've got two sets of rules, one that was developed by California that they gave a waiver to set up their own rules. About 10 states have opted into. I know your state, the governor wants to opt in, but has not yet been able to. And those states are going to go to a total ban on all internal combustion vehicles by 2035. And they've got a 43% mandate for model year 27, which is right around the corner. It's only 2 years away, which is to say in those 10 states, only 57% of all vehicles sold are allowed to be internal combustion vehicles in just 2 years from now, in model year 27. For the rest of the states, though, the Biden administration has EPA mandates that don't quite get to a complete ban, but they do get to about a 70% mandate by 2032, which is to say only about 30% of all vehicles sold in 2032 will be allowed to be internal combustion nationally. And for model year 27, which, as I said, is right around the corner, 2 years away, they have a 32% mandate. So, again, it's not as bad as the 43% in those California car states, but if 85 or 90% of people want an internal combustion vehicle and only 68% are allowed to get one thanks to, you know, the EPA rules, you're still going to have a disaster on your hands because you're going to have a lot more people who want gas and diesel vehicles than the manufacturers are allowed to sell them to, which means prices are going to go haywire, EVs are going to stack up on dealers' lots, and not everyone who wants an internal combustion vehicle is going to be able to get one. And so we're looking at a disaster, not just in sort of the medium to long term, but really in the short term, really just 2 years from now. And it's going to be even worse in the California car states, but it's going to be bad everywhere.
Are there even going to be EVs available? We have seen a number of major manufacturers here, Phil, that have been cutting back on the number of EVs that they are producing because, well, people aren't buying them.
Yeah, I think the EVs are going to be available because the manufacturers have mostly shifted their production over to that. And, as you point out, they've scaled back their ambitions considerably, but they've scaled them back because inventories are building. And so if you want an EV, there are a lot of those on dealer lots. What we're already starting to see a shortage of are the non-EV vehicles, and that's what's going to get a lot worse. And so if an EV works for you, it's a good time to be in the market for them, especially the used ones. The prices have really, really plunged. Hertz is selling about half of all of theirs, the rental car agency. So EV prices have come down a lot, especially with all the subsidies, and especially if you're in the market for a used one. It's the people who don't want an EV, they're looking at the real sticker shock right now because we've got a dwindling supply and a lot of demand for them still. And as I said, it's going to get a lot worse over coming years if these mandates are in place.
There's starting to be some pushback. A congressman from Michigan by the name of John James is spearheading a drive. What sort of effort is underway in Congress to dial back the radical environmentalism that we're seeing out of the Biden administration?
Yeah, well, we've actually had successful bipartisan votes in both the House and Senate to ban the EV mandates. I think we got about 15 or 17 Democrats in the House, and I know we had exactly three in the Senate. It was Manchin from West Virginia, Tester from Montana, and the big surprise was Sherrod Brown from Ohio, who never votes against the Greens, but you can tell he's running for his life politically. Your two senators voted with Biden, voted not to overturn the EV mandates, which is disappointing, especially because, you know, Fetterman always talks such a big game about how he's not progressive anymore or whatever, but he didn't vote with us on that one. And, of course, Casey always does whatever Biden wants. But we're going to have another run at it. Thanks to John James has got the House version of Congressional Review Act resolution to ban the EV mandates, and Pete Ricketts from Nebraska has the Senate version. And the difference between this and the vote that they just had, where it got 52 votes but that wasn't enough, is this one is a privileged motion in the Senate, so it cannot be filibustered. And so probably sometime in September we're going to have this move in the House and Senate. And it will get to the president's desk. I'm pretty optimistic. We'll have majorities in the House and Senate, but I'm hoping we'll have big majorities and we'll have a lot of public pressure behind it because then we'll really put Biden to the test. And, you know, look, I mean, I don't have any illusion. He probably will veto it, but I think we can make that a very, very unpleasant day, a very painful day for him when it comes to his desk if we make him choose between something that people really care about and they know about and they're engaged on, and he'll either have to do the right thing and reverse his EV mandates, or if he uses that veto, people will be paying attention, and it'll be one of the things that motivates them on election day. So that's where things stand right now, and we're really putting our efforts into getting in as big a showing as possible on those votes.
And these electric vehicle mandates are not the only area where the federal government under Joe Biden is trying to micromanage our own households, in fact. They're also trying to put standards into place to limit the type of dishwashers and washing machines we have. any effort to try to reel that back in?
We have had some votes on the appliance standards, and we may have more. It's been a little bit difficult to get people really engaged on that in terms of something where you could get real pressure on the president. I think that those will probably, like a lot of regulations, they'll sort of ride with the presidential. I think if we get Trump back in, we will get, you know, he had a great guy in charge of the Energy Efficiency Division at DOE last time. We can get someone good in there again. We can reverse a lot of these regulations. The challenge, of course, is getting the manufacturers to actually make the devices that people want and the appliances that people want, as opposed to just sort of going along with these things. And so that is a challenge. But I think that those rules, and we have had a House vote on, you know, each of them, things like dishwashers, washing machines, and they've passed, but not with a lot of attention, and we haven't been able to get action in the Senate. So the best chance on those would be a change in administration.
Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us a little bit about American Commitment. Also, where can folks find you on the web?
AmericanCommitment.org is the website. We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and we try to develop strategies where a little bit more citizen engagement can make the difference and win some of these fights.
Phil Kirpin from American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Have a great one.
It is known as FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. It is used by millions of college students. But a redesign of the online application has turned into a tech disaster, as we learn from Eric Boehm and Emma Camp of Reason Magazine.
At the same time that the Biden administration is still trying to forgive tons of student loans, well, President Joe Biden's Department of Education is jeopardizing access to future financial aid for millions of college students and their families by creating a website that no one seems to be able to use. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is, she's been here a few times before on the show, and she is an assistant editor at Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine, and increasingly the person that I turn to whenever I want to understand what's going on with the kids these days. It's Emma Camp. Emma, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Emma's also just recently been named one of the 25 Voices of Freedom by FIRE. So that's very exciting. She's everywhere, very busy. We appreciate her giving us some of her time here today. Emma, look, I remember being in college. It's a little fuzzy these days, honestly, but I do remember filling out the FAFSA. That's the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. It's the form that you have to fill out if you want to get any type of federal student aid, as it sounds like. I remember it being kind of annoying, but it sounds like it's actually gotten more than just annoying this year.
Yes. This year, filling out the FAFSA has become downright impossible for a lot of people. So, yes, as you were saying before, the FAFSA is the financial aid form that is required for anybody seeking federal grants and loans. But not just that. Almost every single college, private and public, requires a FAFSA form, and they use that to calculate their own financial aid packages. So a lot of times if you apply to schools, your college will offer you some amount of financial aid. That is almost always comes from filling out a FAFSA. So these forms are very important. Just about anybody who has gone to college in the past few decades or has a child who has filled out one of these forms. And every year, about 15 million people or more end up filling it out. So this is a really huge thing in a lot of people's lives. But in 2020, Congress passed this really huge bill, and part of that bill was a requirement to simplify the FAFSA form. And on its face, it sounds like a pretty good idea. As you mentioned, it is kind of a long and complicated form where you have to put in a lot of financial information, and the idea of making that simpler seems great, right? Well, the Education Department really fumbled the ball with the execution here. So they did a soft launch of the form on New Year's Eve of 2023, which was about 2 months later than they normally released the form. And they called it a soft launch because a lot of people couldn't even get into it at all. It was only periodically available. And so they released it 2 months later than they normally do. But they did move up the deadline. And even after they released it, it was just incredibly buggy. People would have such a hard time just getting into the form. If they accidentally clicked the wrong box, they couldn't unclick it or the form wouldn't work for them. There was a really long time where students who didn't have Social Security numbers, or rather their parents didn't have Social Security numbers, these are usually students with undocumented parents, were unable to complete the form. And because of this, a lot of people didn't fill out the form at the deadline, which happened at the end of May. FAFSA completions were down 13.5%, which is well over a million people not filling out this form that is really necessary to go to college, because colleges have these massively inflated sticker prices that almost nobody pays. So if you don't fill out the FAFSA, you end up getting stuck with this price that you're not really meant to pay.
It sounds like a mess. I'm having flashbacks to the rollout of the Obamacare website of healthcare.gov, which of course was plagued for months and years with problems like this. We're now getting a sense of how significant this the impact of this failed rollout could be. The piece you wrote for Reason Today talks about the number of, there's a potentially a huge drop in the number of kids who'll be attending college next year. Now maybe that's a good thing. That's a whole other debate for another day. But there's real ramifications here that are starting to filter in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is probably the largest government tech-related website bungle since healthcare.gov. It's just a huge, frustrating mess. And this is a problem for a lot of colleges, because college financial aid offices rely on these forms to give kids accurate information of their financial aid packages. And so a lot of people were staring down this May 1st deadline, which is the deadline that most colleges use for when you have to commit to them, without having financial aid packages or not knowing if their financial aid package is way bigger than it's supposed to be. And so they're just not getting an accurate view of how much they're going to be on the hook for when it comes to getting a college education. And this is also a problem for a lot of smaller schools, because there was sort of a post-recession or post-2008 crash birth rate decline. And so a lot of small schools are starting to struggle with getting students to enroll because there aren't enough students, period. And then if you have a bunch of kids who aren't going to college who might have otherwise because they didn't fill out this form, it creates this self-fulfilling mess that leads a lot of small colleges to close.
Yeah, it seems like it's bad for the schools, obviously bad for the students, complicated and frustrating for parents as well, I'm sure. We're chatting with Emma Camp. She's an assistant editor at Reason.com. She's been following the mess with the FAFSA rollout this year. That's the form that students have to fill out to get student aid. Emma, not a lot of time left here, but real quick, do we have any sense of what's ultimately behind this, who the culprit is? Is this just a typical government incompetence, or is there something more acute than that?
So the actual cause is not super clear. It was probably rushed. However, a last beat that I will add is there isn't a lot of indication that things are going to be better next year. Normally, the FAFSA has a sort of preview that goes out earlier in the year, and they were not on time. And I can't remember off the top of my head whether they've even released that preview, but even if they've released it now, they will release it several months late. So that basically means that there's an indication that there are a lot of problems with next year's form. So this might continue for a couple more years, which is even worse news.
Yeah, real mess. Of course, some college students getting their loans forgiven. Others would just like to get their loans, would just like the federal form to work.
Or would just like their college to give them money, right?
Yeah, exactly. This affects, right, not just the federal loans, but the private ones as well. That's an important point there as well. We're unfortunately out of time for today, but this is a real mess. You can read more about it via Emma's coverage at Reason.com. Emma, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks so much.
And again, that's Emma Camp. She's an assistant editor at Reason. Again, check out her work there on free speech issues, on the FAFSA problems, and on a host of other topics that she covers for us. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump are set for their first debate. Dr. Paul Kengor is editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, and he says there may be no winner on this American Radio Journal commentary.
There's much debate over a Trump-Biden presidential debate. The when, the where, how many? A reporter in Manhattan recently asked Donald Trump whether he would like to debate President Joe Biden. Trump didn't hesitate. He reiterated his earlier statement that he is ready to debate Biden, quote, anytime, anywhere, any place, unquote. Bring it on. Joe Biden, in turn, said the same. He didn't back down. He told Vulgarian shock jock Howard Stern that he's, quote, happy to debate Trump, unquote. Both Biden and Trump were talking a little smack, pounding their chests, ready and rearing to go. But whether that's good thinking by either man is, well, frankly, a matter of debate. It is for Biden, and especially, I think, for Donald Trump. Remember what happened in 2020. I'm convinced, and I'm not alone, that Donald Trump lost his reelection bid in the first debate with Joe Biden on September 29th, 2020. Trump behaved like a maniac. He couldn't keep his mouth shut. Interruption, interruption, interruption. In his defense, well, I know why Trump took such a combative approach. His advisors were probably mindful of Vice President Biden's debate with Republican VP nominee Paul Ryan in October 2012. If you'll recall, Biden was insufferably condescending, smirking, rolling his eyes, rudely scoffing at his opponent like a petulant brat. It was one of the ugliest debate displays I've ever seen. Trump and his advisors in 2020 must have been mindful of that from 2012. And so Trump didn't give old smirking Joe a chance this time around. Each time Biden opened his mouth, Trump pounced. He unleashed himself, throwing punch after punch, even after the bell rang. He wouldn't let Biden even get up off the mat. Not that Biden was any better in the debate. He embarrassed himself this time as well. Though unlike in 2012 with Ryan, he was the one getting pummeled. Frankly, it was much deserved, though it didn't score Trump any debate points with voters. Quite the contrary. In all, Trump-Biden wasn't exactly Lincoln-Douglas. To be sure, Donald Trump redeemed himself in the second and final debate he had with Joe Biden on October 22, 2020. This time, Trump was excellent, much more controlled and measured, but it was too late. In the four-week interim, which included a canceled debate because of COVID, and now with the election less than 2 weeks away, the sitting president, Donald Trump, lost millions of mail-in ballots after that first dreadful debate, which in the narrow election that followed, narrow in terms of electoral college votes in key swing states, was decisive against Trump. Trump in 2024 wants to redeem himself. He's chomping at the bit, ready to attack again. But that will not serve him well again. Trump supporters relish the prospect of an addled, sleepy Joe embarrassing himself on national television, struggling with his debate teleprompter. They're hoping for a humiliating dementia Joe moment. It's a sad wish, yes, but they ought to ask themselves, if Joe Biden has such a moment, would he really lose many supporters? They're going to vote for him and against Donald Trump no matter what. Look at what happened in my home state of Pennsylvania in the U.S. Senate debate between John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz. Fetterman couldn't even read from the teleprompter, even when given a teleprompter. Did it matter to his voters? Pfft, not at all. The same would be true if Joe Biden self-destructed on national television. In other words, Donald Trump has nothing to gain but much to lose from a debate. He has been ahead of Biden in the poll since October. That's really unusual for Trump, who never led Hillary or Biden in 2016 or 2020 like that. Trump could do what Biden did in 2020. He could campaign from his basement in 2024. When you're ahead, like Trump is, don't do anything dumb to blow your lead. Restrain your worst impulses, assuming that's possible for Donald Trump. But as for us spectators, we'll sit back and watch the spectacle. But whether the debacle will be good for democracy is a matter of debate. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWON-FM in Waynesboro, Tennessee, WBUQ-FM in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, along with KCIL-FM in Yuma, Louisiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.